You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. You're listening to a discussion on abolishing corporate personhood from the National Conference on Organized Resistance. We continue.
I guess I was going to talk a little bit about what we did in Point Arena before we dove into the court cases. We started a couple years ago, a group of us, it was an Alliance for Democracy chapter, and we were very, I guess you might say, pumped up about the whole Seattle WTO thing, and you know, we were really going on it, and we heard a Poklad lecture. It was well, they used to have these, I guess they still do, rethinks, they call them, rethinking the corporation. You take all day and you just kind of try and rethink everything that you've learned about corporations. And the issue of corporate personhood just jumped out at the people in our group as being the linchpin, the key. And so we wanted to do something about it. And we very naively jumped into this and just said, we'll just change that, you know. We'll just get rid of that in our town. So we tried to look at ways that we could do it. We tried to put it on the ballot. It's illegal to put this on the ballot. You can't vote to take away the rights of a person. Well, that's good, but it's a catch-22. And anything that ever gets on a ballot, this was just a really good learning process, anything that gets on the ballot is put on by the city attorney. In the case of a city ballot, this, you know, the attorney general in the case of a state, and they just won't put it on. They just say no. Signatures, doesn't matter. We won't put it on. So we kept thinking, how can we get around? So what we did was we took it in form of a non-binding resolution, sort of like a corporate personhood free zone, to the city council. And after much argument in the newspapers, which was really what we wanted, because we needed publicity, we wanted the discussion. We had really wanted it to be a more democratic process, but these are elected people, and they passed it 4-1. The one who didn't pass it just sort of threw up his hands and said, I don't even know what you guys are talking about. But I assume it was because he didn't read his information. But it was not legally binding. I have to say that. But the fact that we were able to convince people who had never heard of this concept 2 years ago that it was wrong, and that if they had had the power, that they would have changed it, I thought that was pretty good. And so people have looked at that since then, and there's a lot of other towns trying to get at it. In fact, the whole state of Maine is trying right now. Pennsylvania, Tom Lindsay is trying to make something more binding. And there's a lot of exciting stuff going on about it. And the reason I wanted to bring that up is because when you hear things like Molly so, you know, laid it all out, it gets kind of depressing. And you think, there's just, like, no way this is going to, you know. But there is a way, I think, and I think it's town by town, small community by small community, till we have, you know, enough people to go state levels. This is our game plan. If someone's got a better one, we'll try that too. The other game plan would be to take a court case to the Supreme Court and have it retried, but I don't like that personally because, first of all, I think we'll lose. Secondly, I think, well, it could be a publicity stunt, but I don't really think they have the right to decide this. I think that's the problem in the first place. Supreme Court should not have decided it in the first place, and they shouldn't be deciding it a second time. So it really should be, this should be a question of the people deciding this sort of thing. I have copies of this timeline for you so you don't have to try and read it, or you know, you don't have to write it down. And but I think we might want to do a song first. We're going to try. I wrote a song because I learn things differently than other people. I learn things by hearing them and often by saying them, not so much by reading them or listening to someone else. You know. So I wrote this song. It's to the tune of This Land Is Your Land, and I think we can all sing it. And well, soon we can sing it. I also wanted to talk a little bit, while you guys are passing this out, about why we chose to go about change in this way. And I guess the way to describe this, I mentioned before the group Poklad, And there's a table here by Poklad. Are the people from the Poklad table here?
Are here.
Yeah. Go see them at their table if you want more information on this group. I would say, I suppose they don't like the term think tank, but they're kind of like a think tank. And they came up with a lot of these ideas. Poklad suggests that there are four major areas in the Constitution where corporate rights are lodged and need to be dislodged. Personhood is only one of them. There's also property, contracts, and the Interstate Commerce Clause. And if anybody feels more drawn to work on one of those areas, there's a lot of work to be done in those areas too. But some of us felt that we'd go for personhood first, feeling that would, I don't know, I was drawn to it. I was almost felt, Molly and I both feel we were kind of called to it. It just spoke to us as what we wanted to do. But whatever you feel that you need to do, I mean, there's many things that need doing. So the idea, Molly mentioned the regulatory agency, and I think that that's where a lot of us have been working on our activism. We've been doing, you know, working through the regulatory agencies. We've been working through boycotts, pickets, protests, puppets, you know, try a lot of things like that. But we might be frustrated if we feel that we're not getting there. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't stop doing those things. But, well, the metaphor that we use a lot is there's all these babies flowing down the river. And everyone's rapidly pulling out all these babies. And they're like, oh, my God, you know. But some of us have got to go upstream and see who's throwing the babies in the river. And that was the concept that Poklad was working on. When you go upstream, though, you find that there's this wall. And it says no trespassing and all that. And a lot of people go, oh, well, you know, can't go there, no trespassing. But we feel that you really must, and that wall is really the Constitution. I think that we really do have to look at where the root of this problem is. But that doesn't mean we have to stop taking the babies out of the river as they come down. Every, you know, timber harvest cut is important, and we have to look at that. So it's a lot of work, but I do think that of all the things that we could do, if we could just do one thing, the most nearly to a silver bullet would be corporate personhood. It wouldn't do everything, but it would give us an opening by which we could change things. The one way to look at what we need to do for action, I think, is to look at what the corporation and the corporation's lawyers are doing for action and do the opposite. But they are not going in certain directions for nothing. They're going because they know that's where they want to get, and we've got to stop with it. So we have to look at what the legal trail is and either go back and cut it off or, you know, stop what's going on now. I know that it's not as fun. It took me a long time to get interested in looking at legal cases. I am very much not a lawyer. As a costumer, you know, I mean, nothing like this at all. But once you get into it, it's almost like reading a mystery novel. Well, who's going to sing this song with me? Molly, I'm not singing it alone.
Yep.
I tried to put all the facts about that I could think of in this song. So you could keep it and it would be a lot of information. I am a person, you are a person, with flesh and blood and with mind and conscience. The corporation is not a person, that word belongs to you and me. They rape and plunder the world's resources, destroying forests and killing wildlife. The corporation must turn a profit, trampling over you and me. They dump big money into elections, buying our Congress and legislatures. The corporation, a legal fiction, now has more rights than you and me. The robber barons bought off the judges to give them rights in the Constitution. Who said the courts had the right to do that? That all belongs to you and me. The First Amendment protects our freedom of free expression and of religion. The corporations have gone and stole it. Those rights belong to you and me.
The Fourth Amendment requires warrants for search and seizure, but corporations evade the health codes and regulations and environmental laws. Whenever Walmart destroys a main street and all the people rise up in protest, the corporate cries of discrimination override democracy. If we the people are truly sovereign and rule the country through our elections, then we must take back from corporations rights that were meant for you and me.
I really do think that whatever we do, the question of who is and who is not to be considered a person in our democracy is crucial. And so what I did with the timeline, and I don't know if you can read this.
Do you want me to point?
No, but they have copies.
Oh, right, okay.
But I'm going to point just generally. The top of the timeline is when corporations got and lost rights and powers. And the bottom is when people gained or lost rights and powers. I started just a tiny bit before the revolution, and I've gone up to almost now. But I went up to all the current Supreme Court cases up to now, except maybe the Patriots Law, or whatever it's called, Patriots Act. And just to have an overview of it, like Molly said, one pattern that you start to see is that although you see that there's court cases on both sides and things, they may have been losses. They are losses on the people's side. People gained rights by amendment, the very difficult process of amendment. And the corporations always got the rights by Supreme Court decision. And I think that's really important to keep in mind as we look through this. I guess I'll just start here with Somerset's case. People don't know that very much, and it's not an American case. But it's my belief, that this case was one of the causes for maybe even the Revolutionary War. Remember how people were originally talking about before the Revolution, no taxation without representation, that cry? The idea of that was really that they wanted to become part of England. They wanted to be. They didn't want to be a colony. They wanted to be part of England. Suddenly that all changed, and they didn't want to be part of England. They wanted to be a separate country. This case, 1772, you notice how close it is. The ruling in that case was that slavery was illegal in England, and if a slave set foot on English soil, they were free. So suddenly they wondered, I would think, and I believe that this may have been one of the reasons that people suddenly decided to fight a war and to get their independence, because they included in the U.S. Constitution, which I've included as a on the corporation side, almost the same opposite wording of Somerset's case. A slave is not free when he gets to free soil, is basically what they said in the Constitution. So they wanted to make that very clear. And if you look at the Anti-Federalist and the Federalist Papers, there were lots of arguments about that. So, Somerset's case, we have a war, and then we have the Constitution. And we had the Bill of Rights, as Molly explained, which was people having the rights. And it was the first 10 amendments of the Constitution is what we consider the Bill of Rights. And as she said, very few people were considered people under those Bill of Rights. It was the white males of property over 21. Constitution was basically a property, document. Who owns what, how that will all come down. I'm going to just kind of, I don't know how much we can go, because I want to take questions, because that's really where everything gets interesting. But Marbury versus Madison, that's the case where the Supreme Court suddenly comes to the forefront and says, we'll be making the decisions now, thank you. We're supreme. And that's important because that was the tool by which the corporations in this case, you know, began to get their rights. I've included Dartmouth College case. That case is about Dartmouth College, the state of New Hampshire, is it New Hampshire, right? Wanted to make it a public university. And it was chartered by the King of England originally. And they thought, well, we'll just, you know, we won the war, let's pull that charter and let's make it a public university. And the Supreme Court said no. But what they said was extra important. They said a charter is a contract and cannot be interfered with by government. Which suddenly, whoa, what a gift, right? Suddenly all corporate charters then are contracts. It can't be interfered with by government. So then what happened, since the Supreme Court said that, then a whole bunch of states started making separate laws, writing right into the charters that they could take them, they could pull them at any time. So the states were already alarmed by that. About that time, as you look down on the people side, the states, different states, were beginning to loosen property rights. You know, they were beginning to say, well, you don't need as much property for the white males to vote. And so more people were beginning to be in the people side of the equation here. Dred Scott, famous case just before the Civil War, is basically it was the opposite of Somerset's case. They got the chance, the court got the chance again to look at that, and they decided, no, that they weren't going to go with English law that had said, you know, a slave is free on free property, on free land, that they would go with basically the Constitution. So they had a perfect right to do that, but they upheld that. They had an opportunity to overturn it. They decided not to. Anyway, let's see what's important. Then we got to the 14th Amendment. I'm thinking here, some of these cases were attempts were corporations. There were a lot of attempts after the 14th Amendment was passed. 13th, of course, is freedom of the slaves. But the 14th Amendment has the word person in it. Do you see it in your copy? Nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Now, here's the thing. That's important, because the first one, obviously, the first one was not being considered, the first word person in that. They were not fighting about that. They're fighting about the second word person. They're saying that in the first one, yes, they meant black males. In the second one, they meant corporations. That's what they really were saying. And that is what they later agreed to. Slaughterhouse cases were a series of cases. They were not including them. See, this is all the attempts. See if I can get down here. These were all the attempts. Paul, they didn't get it. Slaughterhouse, they didn't get it. Munn, they didn't get it. In fact. But here's an interesting one. Minor versus Happersett. Women went and said, maybe we're the people that they were talking about in the 14th Amendment. Could that be? Could we be people? No. We didn't mean women. So here's where the 14th Amendment begins to get eroded for the black males that were supposed to have it. The Compromise of 1877, which is interesting because election that they kept talking about during this recent election. It's the one that was so similar. Okay, so then there's these railroad tax cases where they really made the push, and there were a series of these cases, and during one of the cases, a senator stood up and he waved what we were calling it an unknown piece of paper. No one ever saw the piece of paper, but he waved it and said, here I have the notes from the original, you know, deliberations about the 14th Amendment Joint Committee. I'm the only surviving member of that committee, and in my notes it says that what we meant by that second word person was corporations. So, but they still didn't decide that case on that ground. That's one of the things that they often do. They just kind of like don't decide it on that ground. But then came Santa Clara. Now, Santa Clara is the one that we always talk about. It's where it really happened, 1886. And what happened was, the Supreme Court said before they started, the court does not wish to hear argument on the question whether the provision in the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which forbids a state to deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws, applies to corporations. We are all of the opinion that it does. Now, that would be this one. Nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the law. So it's just after that comma. That's all they gave them at that point. So, but they didn't, they just said that at the beginning. They didn't actually rule on that. And then they went and decided the case on another issue. And this was a tax case. It was about fences. You know, it wasn't really, it was about, can, the case was about whether Santa Clara County could tax the fences of a corporation if they didn't tax the fences of other people in their backyards or whatever. And Santa Clara County said, yes, we can. And the railroad said, no, you can't. We have to be treated like any other person. And that's when it all came down to this. That's what it was about. Then, right away, they made another play. And Minneapolis, this one right here, they got the rest of the 14th Amendment. They got due process. So then they had the 14th Amendment, and they just went for it. Of the 14th Amendment cases brought before the Supreme Court between 1890 and 1910, 19 dealt with African Americans, 288 dealt with corporations. They wanted it, they got it. These are cases where they began to get other First Amendment Bill of Rights rights. Noble, they went for the Fifth Amendment. They just said they claimed the Fifth Amendment because it had some of the same wording. Then Plessy versus Ferguson. Do you remember that's the separate but equal? That brought in the Jim Crow laws. That pretty much took away the 14th Amendment from the black males. So then they just keep going. They get the Fourth Amendment search and seizure. What I've included here are a lot of dissents, and this is really important. These were not, especially as you get into the 30s, and climate change in this country, this was not a unanimous decision anymore. And in fact, a lot of these decisions were decided by one judge. And there were famous dissents on this, beautiful dissents. Brandeis saying, everybody, they got Brandeis, they got Black, everybody saying things like, they aren't people. They shouldn't be included. You can read them yourself and things. Oh, back here, women finally get the right to vote. But guess what? The women still don't have the 14th Amendment. They don't have the 14th Amendment until 71.
Boo!
I put the dissents on because I think that they can show us that it was not unanimous and that it's still not unanimous. National Labor Relations Act gave a lot of rights to the unions. Taft-Hartley took them away. It just went back and forth. But what I'm saying is this is an act of Congress. This was a big, hard-fought thing. That was an act too, but they just go and turn it right over. That was probably the only act, actually. Brown versus the Board of Education. Some people say that overturned Plessy, but they really didn't say it would overturn Plessy, but it started to overturn it. That with the Civil Rights Act. I like that. C versus the City of Seattle. The Supreme Court grants corporations Fourth Amendment protection from inspection by the city fire department. The fire department could even come in and say, this is dangerous. Things begin to heat up as we get closer to our own time. This is why we're in trouble right now, I think. Poll taxes, finally. Get rid of poll taxes. Women finally get the 14th Amendment in this case right here. It was a divorce case, but they finally did it. Roe v. Wade was decided on the 14th Amendment. So maybe if this hadn't happened, this couldn't happen. Maybe. Maybe they would have decided on some other grounds. You know. Now, if we look at this run up here, all in 1976, that Buckley versus Vallejo, that's where they said money is speech. This is a Fifth Amendment protection against double jeopardy. Now, the problem with that one was, so you tried me for polluting, and you found me innocent. You can't try me again for polluting. You know what I mean? But what if they did pollute again? Just for chance. But then, and this is, advertising is now free speech, is the Virginia one, which is also a big deal with us. That's where we got all the tobacco stuff. Corporations are people and they can't speak. They don't have vocal cords. They have to speak somehow, you know. I don't think there's any logic in this. I think they wanted it and they got it. And in this one, Boston versus Bellotti, they were allowed to use their money speech to overturn a referendum. They could just dump money into the political process, unlimited speech into the political process. So that's how they're using it. And now, and this is, and when people are talking about reforming campaign finance reform, Buckley versus Vallejo and the Bellotti case are the two ones that are blocking getting the corporations out of it. They can make all kinds of other rules, but whatever rule they make has to apply, you know. Well, they don't want to limit free speech, and money is speech. So, I mean, that stuff all has to be overturned. But our belief is, you overturn Santa Clara, or you get rid of that, and they aren't even in the game here. You know, that's all done. They aren't people, so they don't have free speech then. You probably have to take it to court, but... Okay, here's some other stuff. OSHA has to get a warrant to check. That's kind of it. Oh, here's, okay, Bellotti, this one that we were talking about. There was a dissent by White, Brennan, and Marshall, and Rehnquist. They all dissented. So that was a one-vote thing, and that was hugely important to what's happened to our political process. Okay, here, I like this. Pacific Gas and Electric Company. The Supreme Court decides that PG&E was not required to allow a consumer advocacy group to use the extra space in their billing envelope, upholding the corporation's right not to speak and protecting the corporation's freedom of mind. Freedom of mind. Austin, that one up at the top, this is a good thing for us, maybe. Supreme Court upholds limitations on corporate spending in candidate elections. So it says that if there is a compelling interest, the state can put controls. And we could use that more. I mean, I think that's a good sign. Here's the one about the bovine growth hormone. And this is, once again, it's the right not to speak. If you have the freedom of speech, you have the right not to speak. And the corporation's right to speak is more important than our right to know. That's what they decide. So, I just wanted to do that pretty quickly. You have a copy in front of you. You could spend a lot of time talking about these cases, but I wanted to have time for questions, and I don't know where we are for questions. Let me scoot back to more to the center.
No.
All right. Just pull it.
You want me to facilitate, since you can probably get to see as well.
We'll both answer questions.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, so start here in the front.
Yeah, I had two questions. You said first that on the thing, the timeline, state begins to loosen property requirements for white males to obtain voting and citizen rights. So that means under a certain amount of money they couldn't do that, like a certain...
Originally,
repeat the question.
Okay, oh, I'm sorry. The question was about the states loosening the voting rights. Every state, states had a lot more rights in those days. The kind of things, everything that wasn't specifically spelled out in the Constitution was reserved for the states, and they all had these different levels of things. But they were all pretty high. And in fact, they set higher if you wanted to run for governor, you had to own a lot of property. If you wanted to run for, you know, mayor, less, you know, all the way down. And if you wanted to vote, they had a level and all of this. But I guess because of pressure, and I think from more the middle class was saying, you know, we want to be included, they began to lower these things each in an individual state. And they might do it because they thought that it would attract more people, or who knows, you know. But they began to lower those things. And in fact, we see in the corporate charter game the race to the bottom. This was a different kind of race to the bottom. This was an inclusive race to the bottom. And then there was the charter lowering of standards race to the bottom, which brought us Delaware down with, like, you know, anything you guys want. So there was a good side to the state's rights thing and a bad side right there in that same little dichotomy for people. In fact, some states were even letting women vote as early as 1830 as a, like, kind of a come-on. You know, women, move out to Wyoming. We'll let you vote.
I have one more question.
Oh, you're here too.
Sorry, just one more. In the 14th Amendment, the part, nor deny any person within its jurisdiction equal protection of the laws.
Yeah.
Are you saying that that was on purpose they put that in there, or you think they just used it for its purpose? It sounded like y'all were saying it's like they actually put it in there.
I can't believe it. If they wanted to put it in there, why didn't they say corporation? Person and corporation. Why didn't they say that? I don't believe it. I believe that later they thought, aha.
We could use it, yeah.
But even if they did, even if there were some people that did, I don't think that the masses of people who approved that amendment, you know how it takes a lot to, you know, all the states have to ratify it. I don't think they were thinking that.
Yeah.
I really think they didn't think that.
No, and to me what this is a really clear demonstration of is the way power structures work. What they do is not necessarily design a thing to work a certain way, but if your goal is to maintain a few people in charge, you take whatever tool pops into your labs. Oh, we can interpret this way. And I think, so I'm with Jan, I don't think that they intended necessarily to do that. It was just an opportunity to use that. Let's go this guy and then this guy.
I'm wondering if there are any rights that other organizations might enjoy that if, let's just pretend that we were able to deny corporations their legal fictional personhood, might that affect other organizations that we generally like? And
nonprofit corporations, you
should say? Nonprofit organizations or labor unions or any other.
Labor unions don't have this right.
Okay.
They are not people. Only corporations are people, but it's true, the nonprofit corporation too. But okay, can I go for it? Okay. My opinion is they're not people either. They're not people. Now, and if, since they're not people, I don't think they should have rights. If we choose to give them privileges, we should be able to choose to give them privileges, and I think that they should be separated. I don't think that they're, you know, I know why they're doing it. They want the limited liability. Okay, that's a whole other question, and I'm not even for that. But that's actually not what we're talking about here. But I think that we should look at the nonprofits separately and say, okay, maybe we choose to give Greenpeace or the Cato Institute. Remember, there's a lot of left-wing, you know, nonprofits. Right-wing nonprofits. We might choose to give them these privileges, but they're privileges that we still endow. They're not rights that we, you know, our sovereign, but that's what I think the difference is. I think we have to continually remind ourselves that only people have rights.
And there's another piece of that too, which is that it's not, again, it's not a new tactic to say, oh, if you do this, it's going to have all these negative consequences. The slaveocracy did the same thing. They said, oh, you know, maybe slavery isn't such a great thing, but the economy will collapse. No one will have a job. Have we heard these arguments before? They've been around for centuries. So it's going to be a powerful argument that nonprofits could very, I mean, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom is a nonprofit corporation. So we're aware of this. But again, it gets to the heart of what's a human being, who has a right, and what is sovereignty about. We don't want institutions to be confused with us. We want to be really clear about who we are, and so we can handle this in other ways. So this gentleman was saying.
What have been the results of the abolition of corporate personhood in Point Arena?
None. Except
if question.
Oh, what are the effects of the abolition of corporate personhood in Point Arena? And as I was saying, it's not legal. It was just like a symbolic. Although, consciousness raising for sure, it's worked its way into all kinds of things that way.
And one of the things that Jan was explaining to me on the plane when we were flying out here is a tactic that they took was to, it's actually not an abolition. It's simply a resolution stating what they believe. And one of the things they say is, we agree with Justice
Hugo Black.
They could get away with it without trouble because it was a Supreme Court justice that said that corporations are not meant to be persons. So it's definitely an education tool. Sarah?
A couple questions, and a lot of these are not necessarily questions that we're raising because, you know, we're thinking the other way, but that we're going to have to explain this when we go out and talk to people about it. Are corporations persons pretty much across the board in other national systems? And do we have a model for what it would look like? Because the first thing I know people are going to say to me is, then can we regulate them? Can we tax them? Are they responsible for their actions? Can we sue them? And not knowing what it looked like when they weren't persons, I don't know the answers to those or where to send them to check.
We always sued them. They always had standing in court. They could be sued. Sue and be sued. Timeline doesn't start here, but let me go back a little further as to why this question is even up. Back in England, back in whenever, I don't know, way, way long time ago, the laws were written, no person shall steal a sack of wheat. You know, no person shall. So corporations were saying, we're not people, so we can. And then the law said, for purposes of the law, you are people. Okay? That's how this whole kind of idea... So they started calling them artificial people way back a long time ago. And what it meant is you have to follow the same laws as other people. But it didn't mean that you had all the rights of a human being. That's where I think they're going back to historically.
Yeah, let's go over here. The white shirt, black hat.
Why is it if companies are getting more rights and more privileges, why haven't we been able to successfully hold them more responsible? Why aren't shareholders for companies found responsible of polluting, like with Exxon? Why can't they be considered people through that and hold their responsibility for the corporation they're supporting?
The shareholders?
Yeah.
That's the limited liability clause. See, they have both. That's why they have more rights than we do. They have all the rights, but none of the responsibilities. I mean, I think it's not right, but that's the problem.
But part of it, too, is the whole issue of co-optation. I mean, this is the story of the 20th century, is giving people enough breadcrumbs to make them be content with what they've got. So there was a time when owning shares of corporate stock was a thing that a very small percentage of people in the United States did. So having a stock portfolio meant you probably also had a country club membership and a house in the country and all these other things. Well, of course, with employee stock programs, millions and millions of people in this country have stock. So now all of a sudden you have lots of people. You know, their portfolio may only be worth a couple of $1,000s, where the CEO's is worth tens of millions of dollars, but they're bought in at their level of income. And so they're into, I mean, it's a brilliant strategy for co-optation. So that has a lot to do with it. And the other thing is, a piece of the strategy is that corporations have a legitimate right to have a voice in the discussion in the first place, which of course is absurd. People can have a legitimate right, and people can work together as groups if they all have an equal voice in the group, but that's a different thing than what corporations have. They can say we've got these millions of stockholders, but they don't actually represent their personal interests. So does that answer your question enough? There are a couple other hands over here. Yeah, the woman, the dark shirt.
According, was it the 14th Amendment when they said the second person meant person? But prior to that time, the corporation was never referred to as a person. So how, like, could you go to a court and say, you know, that doesn't, like, did anybody bring that point up that was misleading in
that
every
was,
kind of way?
I guess that was why I was kind of going back to old English law where they called them artificial people for purposes of law.
It was old English law.
Yes, but see, then we came out of England.
Right. Mm-hmm.
All
right.
Okay.
Just in response to that, it's important to remember that our judicial system, once we were set up, we had all a lot of the things that were set up in England applied here, so that's why they carried over,
right.
And we considered English common law.
Right.
So everything that applied there applied here. And also about the 14th Amendment, it came like 4 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, so there's no way they're talking about corporations in the context of that. Fast forwarding now, a few days ago, finally in the House, they're going to vote on campaign finance reform. Now, let's assume that they don't do the dirty tricks that they've used before to kill it. If you want to read more about that, read Corruption of American Politics, Elizabeth Drew. And somehow it gets passed, and somehow Bush is drunk and signs it. What can it actually do without abolishing corporate personhood, and also what can the corporations do to get rid of it once it's already once it's been passed and been signed?
Get rid of campaign finance reform?
Well, campaign finance reform, like, you know what? How effective can campaign finance reform actually be without abolishing the corporate personhood?
Yeah, well, one of the things that we tend to feel is that the current reforms are not very reformy. They may be a small improvement, but they're more window dressing. They're not going to do anything to change the balance of power in any fundamental way. But I don't know if that really addresses. I mean, and so if they don't change the balance of power, there's a whole bunch of things that the corporate lawyers can do if they want to do that.
Can I also say that the clean money, like Maine's law, one of the main selling points of that law, I mean, when they come and talk to you and say, but this is such a great thing, we're not even touching Buckley versus Vallejo, we're not even touching that and Bilotti. That's what one of their selling points. They go, we just leave the corporations alone. That's why we can pass this, because it's going to pass constitutional muster. Well, so in other words, it's going to not work, you know? It'll help a little bit, but it's voluntary.
So this gentleman, and then we'll go over there.
This workshop seemed really interesting to me as sort of unique among the rest of what I've seen today, because a lot of the workshops here seem to deal with capitalism and dealing with revolutionary change in social structure and economic structure. And you're talking about a kind of a reform that you think would be a revolutionary reform, kind of. So I'm interested in what you think after this happens. You know, do you think that this would be able to lead to more equitable social conditions and, you know, kind of some more ways that might happen? Because this is sort of the most American kind of rooted workshop I've seen today. You've got people's sovereignty up there on the board, which a lot of people here who are anarchists might think is, you know, kind of a joke. People have elections and they choose representatives, ha ha. So that's what I'm really interested in.
I will add to that. I am an anarchist. And I have full credentials. But, and as my husband, who's also an anarchist, put it when he describes this, okay, you've got your regulatory type of actions. Say you're really just trying to deal with corporate rule, okay? You got your regulatory type of actions. We believe they aren't working. You've got all-out revolution, which, not to say, it isn't happening. It isn't happening right now. Is there a middle ground between those two that might actually bring about radical change with a small surgical, you know, application? I mean, that was what we were looking at. And we have gone back and forth. I mean, you know, if there's a general strike tomorrow, great, you know. Then we'll just roll up that timeline. But the point is, we were just, and also I think it's educational, and I think thinking about, I think in a democracy, deep democracy, real democracy is what we're looking for. That's what I'm looking for. And the question of who is a person will always be valid in that democracy. Yes, that's what I would say. This issue grabbed me because it was about democracy and who is to rule, who's in charge, the people or the corporations or the government, you know? And I would say that the anti-federalist vision was not that far from anarchism. Now, they didn't get it, but their vision, you know?
And I'm going to add to that because I think that that's a really interesting and valid comment. One of the things that I've learned in really studying this and working with this over the last few years is that I didn't have a clue what democracy was about. It's a word that we're steeped in from the cradle. and we're told that we live in a democracy. We do not live in a democracy. The United States has never been a democracy for one day of its existence, and it's not in the Constitution. It's one thing you can sometimes stop people with. Well, maybe they would use the word in the Constitution if that's what they were trying to create, but they had no intention of creating a democracy. And even with the changes that we've had, we don't have democracy now. I don't know if they've only got one copy at the Wobbly table upstairs. They have a book that I really love called Radical Democracy by a man named C. Douglas Loomis. And it was an excellent book for to me to really open my eyes up about what democracy is, because that's what our core issue is that we're trying to live the dream of democracy, and the first thing that we have to do is decolonize our own minds. And that is real uphill work, because most of us don't have a clue of what it is, and having access to the kinds of people, ideas, discussion, and systems to do it is a difficult thing to do. So part of this is trying to chip away enough of the crud that's been stacked on top of it to get access to what it is to try to live more, you know, in a more democratic way. Over there.
I was wondering what it is about Delaware that makes it so special that almost all corporations, even if they're not from Delaware, reside there, and don't you think that offers a good opportunity to, at a grassroots level, change state laws rather than have to battle the Supreme Court or get an amendment passed?
The Delaware story is a good story, partly because New Jersey actually was ahead of it once upon a time. The governor, I can't remember what point this was, but the governor of New Jersey said, hey, we get money for chartering corporations. Let's make it a good deal to charter corporations here. We need money in our state coffers. So New Jersey was getting all, you know, corporations were coming in and chartering there, and Delaware said, two can play this game. And they beat New Jersey in the race to the bottom, which is why Delaware's got the easiest incorporation. So many of the biggest, baddest corporations in this country are chartered there. So it started off as a revenue generation for state coffers. In terms of doing grassroots organizing in Delaware, there was a Wolf woman at one of our congresses a few years ago who lives there, and she said it's brutal there because there are just so many people who live in Delaware who are really, really beholden to the system. I don't live there. That's a single anecdotal comment, but it could be a tough state to do work in.
I was, to quote Richard Grossman, but I was in a session like this where he was asked a question similar to this, and he was talking about there's a lot of people who want to do national chartering of corporations, make a national thing so that it wouldn't be state by state, but he was supporting the fact that we had more opportunity if we kept all 50 venues going, you know, 50 little chances to try and change things, rather than if we got it all in the federal government. So you have to look at it, but I'm not sure that if there was a federal chartering system at this point, that it would be any better. It would probably be Delaware's. They'd probably say, okay,
one big Delaware.
Yeah, one big Delaware, you know?
Back there?
Bay shirt. I'm curious about basically like the possible loopholes to this in terms of like corporate responsibility, like as you were talking about, like, you know, they shifted their strategy from the corporations being on this side of the line, corporations being on that side, as things were changing, as a way of maintaining power. So if we were to abolish corporate personhood, do you have any idea what response they might have in order to attempt to maintain power?
Corporations?
Yeah, or just not corporations, but the people who benefit from corporations, the ruling.
And no doubt they would. The thing that I'm thinking about this is if we ever got to the point, if we as a people actually got to a point where we were able to, through an amendment to the Constitution, change this, we would have gotten to a very big point indeed about a lot of things. It wouldn't come up, this consciousness would not be alone. And I think maybe we would be in a position then to not allow or to put up a structure that would protect it. That's my hope. I mean, I can't imagine. There's many roads to radicalism. This is one of them, you know, for your mind. This is one that opened my mind to a whole system that I didn't understand was happening. But you could probably do it if you looked at property. You could do it if you looked at any of the things, and, you know, any of the ways money's, you know, operating.
And I think that we can count on, if this movement really gets legs, corporations will go after it right away. We've had some lawyers in the movement who have filed some cases and had some conversations with judges, and they, you know, in some cases they're thoughtful and polite, but they're not about to budge on this because they're used to the current system. And to go back to the question that Sarah asked a little while ago, this is not an approach, because it's really trying to go down to a deep level that is necessarily easy to get right away. So because we have a campaign we're working with groups, we're available to talk with people and strategize about it so that we can answer the kinds of questions that people are going to have. Because even though the idea is absurd, and I think it's really easy to hook people in and say, well, of course corporations shouldn't be persons, but then you get into all these other questions. And so if you have a community group that's interested in doing some work on this, please get in touch with us, because we've been working hard on this for a while, and so we'd be really happy to work with folks on a strategy and figuring out some of the responses and questions and that kind of thing. Right here.
Yeah, I was wondering if anyone looked at an earlier timeline, particularly all the things that came from England, but around the abolishment of slavery and serfdom there, how that evolved is that half the serfs were owned by like nobility and all that, half were owned by institutions known as monasteries, parts of the church. And the thing is, the serfs were all freed on the monarchy, which most of us tend to think of as the government's land, because a baron could decide, well, this is my property, makes sense, they're going to uprise anyway, they're offering money, I'm going to free this town. Whereas a bishop would say, even if he wanted to do it, his superiors would say, holy, that's God's property, God didn't say it. And not to be the atheist question or like that, but just for legal purposes, you have to assume that God is a fictional person too. And the thing is this whole question here is, you know, the consciousness isn't there. I'm wondering how many parallels are looked at that. Certainly the Reformation did basically abolish a lot of that in England, and a lot of the effects that did happen, and a lot of them I don't agree with, definitely drastically showed what the country looked like in its political status.
Yeah, one of the things that we look at is that all these ecclesiastical and monarchy and other systems of power that we've had, there are parallels with all of them, because again, they're not about self-determination, they're not about recognizing all people as having equal opportunity and equal rights. So you could draw plenty of parallels with history, depending on who your audience is and how you want to frame your message and that kind of thing. So that definitely is something that we can do.
I'd just like to make a comment about the timeline. This timeline is pretty complete, I would say, as far as the corporations go. It's not complete as far as people go, really. I was just kind of, because this subject is really about corporate personhood, and because there's a whole thing going on with the Native Americans, there's a lot of stuff going even from this time on, but that could be really intense, and I think it should be done at some point, but I don't know how much how much further we can go with this. But you know what I'm saying is, I tried to be really complete with the stuff with the corporations. I know I'm just hitting some highlights with the people.
It's 5:05, and I think this is when this is supposed to end. All they said we could go over. Do people want? Are there more questions, or are we ready to wrap this? We're here if people want to talk to us some more.
This has been a recording of Molly Morgan and Jen Edwards talking about abolishing corporate personhood. The presentation took place at the National Conference for Organized Resistance at American University in Washington, D.C. on January 26th. 2002.
Is there a neighbor you are suspicious of, but lack the motivation to call the federal government? Are you positive the person who lives across the street is involved in Al-Qaeda-like activity, but wonder, what's in it for you to call the FBI? Well, the Department of Homeland Security is proud to present the War on Terror Megamix. For every member of a terrorist organization you reveal, the Department of Homeland Security will send you this great compilation CD featuring hits from the 70s and 80s, like this great hit from The Who. Or how about this great song from the 80s?
Who can it be knocking at my door?
That's right. All of these classic hits can be yours. It doesn't matter if they're guilty or innocent. If someone you know is acting strangely, you could be listening to songs like this. Or even this great one-hit wonder. To get this great compilation, all we need is a suspicious party's address, ethnic background, hair, blood, or urine sample, the Middle East-based terrorist group you suspect they are involved in, and $4 for shipping and handling. And there's even a track for the kids.
Who are the people in your neighborhood? In your neighborhood? In your neighborhood? Say who?
The War on Terror Megamix can be yours right now for just doing your patriotic duty. Inform and order today.
A community forum on total information awareness, homeland security, or Big Brother will be held on Monday, February 24th in Auburn. The event will begin at 7 p.m. at the Calvary Presbyterian Church, 90 Franklin Street in Auburn, across from the Burn Dairy. Guy Cosentino will moderate. The forum will address how do we balance Americans' right to privacy and freedom with national security. Details of the Bush administration's plans for electronic surveillance of American citizens will be discussed, and the implications for our society will be debated. Attendees will have a chance to ask questions of informed panelists or express their own concerns and ideas. The program is free and open to the public. Child care will be provided. The event is sponsored by the Cayuga Coalition for Peace. For more information, contact Jim Ellis at area code 315-252-6029, that's 252-6029. Also, another important event coming up next Friday, February 21st, Hearts of Peace, a joint fundraiser for Voices in the Wilderness, an international humanitarian aid organization, and the Auburn Food Pantry. Hearts of Peace will take place at the First United Methodist Church at 99 South Street, also in Auburn. Soups will be served at 6 p.m., followed by performances of music, poetry, and dance at 7. There is a suggested donation of $3 to $5, and attendees are asked to please bring a non-perishable food item. For updates or questions, call the Hearts of Peace message line at area code 315-689-6815. That's 689-6815 in the 315 area code. Thanks to Mike McCormick and George King for their contributions to tonight's program, and thanks to the volunteers of KCSB in Santa Barbara, California, for their War on Terror Megamix.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. My guns and my saddle will